It's the story of an American held in a dark Venezuelan prison.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
I'm Becky Bruce. I spent a year working on Hope in Darkness, which now has more than 2 million downloads. Find it on KSLpodcast.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Inside Sources. Where KSL offers Utah deeper insights on the news. Host Boyd Matheson divides rage from reason
and elevates the conversation on issues crucial to our community.
On KSL News Radio 102.7 FM and 1160 AM.
A lot of people are back on the bandwagon of the energy independent call following Russia's invasion with Ukraine. And if it can be green energy that powers our future, can that be possible? Is that really the answer? A lot of people say, yes, that's exactly what we want. So then the question is green energy really the silver bullet that we think it is? Is there a silver bullet as it relates to energy policy? Or is it more complicated than that? Let's begin.
Think you know the news of the day?
Think again.
Very pleased to have back on the program Phil Rossetti. He's the resident senior fellow at the R Street Institute studying energy and energy policy. And thanks for joining us today, Phil.
Thanks for having me.
Of course, everybody's feeling the pain, the pinches at the pump and looking at gas and energy prices. And obviously, there's a lot more to it than just what's happening in Ukraine and what's happening with Russia. You had a piece in Real Clear Policy talking about the fact that there as we look at how do we deal with all of this, there really is no lovely silver bullet in terms of energy security, is there?
Unfortunately, there isn't. We got to remember that global energy demand is huge. It's a massive portion of total global consumption. Energy production is huge and it takes place all around the world. And as a result, we're kind of at the mercy of these global swings in supply and demand. That also mitigates our opportunities to have some sort of silver bullet or one-size-fits-all solution that we can just implement at home. And you'll always hear the politicians say, okay, you know, we've got it. Here's the answer. Here's what we're going to do. And then they're not always going to be the best solutions.
Yeah. I'm glad you pointed out the politicians on that because they think there's just a silver bullet for everything. And there are no silver bullets. I'm going to write a book by that title. There are no silver bullets. You brought into your piece, Phil, just some really great comparisons. Going back to 1979, of course, President Carter delivered his famous crisis of confidence speech, which interestingly, there's a lot of good stuff in there, aside from the energy policy pieces that I think were the big downer of that particular speech. But give us the application of that. What happened then and how are we seeing that replay now?
It was a really interesting time for energy policy because, you know, similar to now, gas prices had essentially skyrocketed. And this is largely due to political pressure that was applied from OPEC over the U.S. support of Israel. And at the time, there were price controls on domestic oil. So there really wasn't a lot of domestic oil production, and we were really reliant on foreign suppliers. So the solutions that government was pushing were a lot of things like, you know, solar. President Carter famously put solar panels on the roof of the White House. At the time, we used a lot of oil for electricity, so it made sense to pursue that. And there was also, you know, this idea of renewable fuels, alternative fuels, and interestingly enough, shale oil, which really didn't come into its own about 30, 40 years after the fact. Wow. After President Carter's big speech, President Reagan won the election. He came into office. He lifted price controls. And then domestic producers increased their production and the prices came down. So I think what we're seeing here is this push for some new solution or, hey, don't worry about gasoline prices. We're going to go EVs or something like that. Those things are really far off, even though politicians have their eyes set on that now. And we really shouldn't ignore the basic aspects of how do we increase supply in the near term to bring relief.
Yeah. And haven't we seen that as well in places like Germany who tried to do just that, flip the switch, you know, move to renewables and green and electric cars and suddenly found themselves actually more dependent on Russian oil than before. Is there danger in trying to make that leap? I think everybody agrees, let's be careful stewards of the environment. There are ways that we can be cleaner and greener and all of those things. But isn't there also some risk that we end up being more dependent on that?
I think it depends a lot on how we go about this. EVs are good not just for the environment, but actually reducing our sort of level of influence that we see to foreign energy producers. But we also need to be cognizant of our own energy production, that we're not saying, okay, put a lid on domestic energy production and just push the EVs. It really should be, okay, how do we reduce our dependence on any kind of foreign suppliers, or reduce their influence while still pursuing EVs and domestic energy production? So I think that's the big misstep that we see, where if you try to centrally plan this or think that you have the solution, you're just going to push it, that's where you really run afoul, because it takes a long time to make these transitions and you can't get around interim energy demand.
Yeah, and that's one of the areas where we've seen President Biden lean in. Obviously, he's made some requests to foreign countries to increase production. How is that playing out, and how is that likely to impact that supply and ultimately the prices?
Well, it hasn't played out well for him. So early on with the spike in gasoline prices, President Biden was going to Iran, Venezuela, trying to get them to increase their oil production, Saudi Arabia especially. And before Russia's invasion of Ukraine, he had gone to all the members of OPEC Plus making this request, which essentially included Russia. This doesn't really work well, because these countries are artificially constraining their production, because they're not private companies that produce oil in those countries. It's really a state-owned enterprises. So they're all working in concert as a cartel to keep production low and force prices up to increase their own profits. So for them, they like this environment. They're very happy with the high energy prices and that they don't have to increase their production. And the only thing we could offer them would be some sort of concession or reduction of sanctions on them, which is probably, you know, not a good foreign policy, because you would just signal to everyone that, hey, you know, we really care about human rights or these really big, important international issues, but only when gas prices are low. So that's what we need to avoid. And President Biden hasn't found any success in that strategy thus far.
Yeah, and obviously, if you centrally plan, you also have the potential of missing the up and coming, the even better, the new technology. If you're, you know, if you're picking winners and losers from command and control central, what are some thoughts in terms of going green and controlling the cost? But how do we actually do that in a way that we can make it more reliable, sustainable, and affordable?
Well, you hit the nail on the head about this need for competition. So when we think about a global energy transition addressing these big environmental issues, which are, you know, obviously very important and going to stay with us for a long time, the key is, okay, how do we do this at a low cost and really incentivize global adoption of new technologies? To get there, you have to have a competitive environment where someone says, hey, you know, I've got a cheaper EV or something, and, you know, these high gasoline prices are going to make it a really good deal or a good bargain, or maybe an alternative liquid fuel. You know, maybe ethanol prices could come down or something like that. These sort of innovations only happen when you have a free and robust energy market. If you try to say, okay, you know, this is the solution, everyone buys an EV or everyone uses renewable fuels, you might actually be preventing the rise of a potentially better technology. So it really takes some humility on the part of politicians to understand, hey, we don't know everything. We've got to have a market that allows for new entrants. And also that means that there is going to be some level of continued use of incumbent suppliers, which are, you know, conventionally fossil fuels in the interim. So it really is just about restraint and valuing the outcome rather than trying to dictate the outcome.
I think that's so important, and I do think humility is the indispensable trait. If we could just import that a little bit into Washington, D.C., I think that would go a long way. Before I let you go, Phil, one of the other things that we often see in Washington is something that you point out powerfully in your piece, and that is that so often we end up with politicians who focus on energy policy on an ideal world rather than the real world. What's the bridge to make sure that we're shooting for the ideal, we're going for those kinds of things in big ways, while still living in the reality of the here and now, the demand that's clearly outpacing the supply?
I would say the big answer to that is some understanding of giving credence to the market and getting those outcomes. So the real risk with this kind of idealized system is if you are in a position where you are using your authority to say, okay, here's what you can't do because, you know, we've run the numbers and we know that this is cheaper or something like that, that is going to run afoul of reality because it's just not possible for someone in Washington to have perfect knowledge of everyone's individual cases and situations. If we want to get those outcomes, really it comes down to making sure that we have some sort of value of those outcomes. There's a ways of doing that in a more market-friendly environment. We look at, some systems where they have, like cap and trade mechanisms or things like that, which are probably not going to pick up here. They're not very popular. But really making sure that we're saying, okay, it's the emissions we want to address, making sure that we're accounting for life cycle emissions, maybe considering how a lot of our natural gas exports actually displace foreign coal or higher emitting sources of energy. Looking at that and saying we want to allow those solutions to flourish, I think is better than saying we have the solution and therefore you must adopt it.
Great insight as always. Phil Rossetti, resident senior fellow at the R Street Institute, studying energy and energy policy. Phil, thanks for joining us as always today.
Thanks for having me.
As always, there are no silver bullets, but there's a lot of important thinking and even more important conversations to be had when it comes to becoming energy independent.
Think again with Lloyd Matheson on KSL News Radio.
It's the story of an American held in a dark Venezuelan prison.
Then all of a sudden they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
I'm Becky Bruce. I spent a year working on Hope in Darkness, which now has more than 2 million downloads. Find it on KSLpodcast.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.